Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future.
The people's flag is deepest red, it's shrouded off the mass of day. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Carl Weiderquist. He is the American coordinator of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network, which is part of an international network of organizations working on a citizen's income or a basic income or a guaranteed income. Welcome, Dr. Weiderquist.
Hello.
Now, how did you get involved in this topic?
Well, it's something that I've been interested in a long time, but I got interested in working on it when I was in graduate school. I used to have political arguments with two of my friends who are sociologists, and I'm an economist. And one day we came to the question of, well, what policy could we all agree on is a good next step? And we came up with the basic income. And one of us said, well, then we should write a paper on it. And so we wrote a paper on it, and I've been writing on it ever since.
So you were part of the U.S. Radical Political Economy Group, BERPE. I mean, do you consider yourself a leftist, or did you come at this kind of de novo?
Well, it was I don't fit easily into those categories. I suppose I am a leftist, but I don't I don't favor the type of policies that a lot of leftists favor. I favor trying to create a market-based economy without poverty. So very leftist goals, but not necessarily a radical change in institutions.
Now, one of the ironies of this particular policy proposal is that people occasionally on the right get attracted to it as a way of simplifying the welfare state and reducing the nanny state's intrusion into people's choices of what they do with redistributive income. And in fact, in the Nixon administration, there was some interest in basic income, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. There was actually a very strong interest in basic income at that time, under the name of the guaranteed income or the negative income tax, when a lot of left-wing people and a lot of right-wing people started to come to this idea at the same time. Its attraction then for a lot of American conservatives was that the welfare state had become really large and complex and cost much more than what they were actually doing, and a basic income, which would give a little bit of money to everybody so that no one is completely destitute, then appealed to conservatives as a simplification of the welfare state and a way to try to achieve its goals at a much lower overhead cost than you get with our current means-tested system, which it costs a lot of money to decide who's eligible for each particular program, but now we've added new expenses, whereas you not only have to go through this difficult means test, but then you have to come up with all this work for the recipients to do, which also costs money.
Now, most conservatives don't like this idea at all because they see it as an expansion of the idea of entitlements and of government services. One of the complaints that people have on the right about this idea is that it would inhibit labor productivity and the motivation to get to work, a complaint that they have about almost every welfare state program. Now, what's an economist's response, a promoter of this idea? What would your response be about labor productivity and the incentive to work?
Well, there are several responses you can make to that, and one of the most important is a purely practical consideration, which is that a basic income actually has a much better work incentive than any of the current programs if you're eligible for them. Well, except possibly for TANF, but the reason for that is if you're eligible for disability under under the Social Security system. And then you can only keep that money as long as you can prove that you're unemployable. If you have unemployment insurance, you get that money as long as you don't take a job, but the moment you lose that job, you lose all of that money and your eligibility for it. Basic income is structured so that everyone has a minimum, but as you work more, that minimum that you have is taxed away, so it gets smaller and smaller, so that you're always better off earning more money privately than less. The current system does not have that feature. You have people that are clinging to their whatever status they have that'll make them eligible for their programs, who are afraid to take jobs, who actually might take jobs if we didn't make it so risky for them. So in that sense, basic income is actually it actually has a positive work incentive. Where it doesn't have a work incentive is the fact that more people are eligible for it than than our current system. Our current system tries to define the good poor and the bad poor, and the good poor get these programs and the bad poor don't get anything, or they get a very punitive program like we have now in TANF. But the problem with separating that is, well, one problem is it's very expensive, but the problem for work incentives is that you're going to have some people that really are needy and aren't going to meet the eligibility requirements, and that's why we've had ballooning homelessness ever since we've been trying to cut back on our welfare system. We have a bunch of people that are quite obviously in quite severe need who are not eligible. And if we have to accept some decline in work incentives in order to have less than a million people sleeping on heat crates at night, I don't think that's an unacceptable side effect.
One of the classic arguments for this idea of a guaranteed income is the idea that industrialization and automation and computerization would start robbing us of work and there would be structural unemployment, which would make it impossible for everyone to have a job. Do you think clearly that would be one of the material conditions which would support our shift towards this policy, but is that a necessary condition for us to shift that way?
I don't think it is a necessary condition, I don't think that it's necessary that technology is going to create more unemployment. That's always a question of whether it will or whether it won't. In the short run, a new kind of technology can replace workers and cause a temporary unemployment, or it can create a new demand for a whole new type of workers. And there's always the two things happening together. And what you seem to get is not a real trend either way, but this constant churning. And so this increase in the level of unemployment and the amount of time it takes you to go from one job to another job, because the jobs are changing and you often need a lot of retraining. Suddenly everybody needs to design websites and they all learn that and they get these new jobs, and then we find we have 10 times as many web designers as we need, and some of them have to go into retraining to find something else. So you get more turnover with jobs and longer periods of unemployment, but it's not essential that you're going to have actually less jobs than you have people. But what's important is that we have the option of using some of our technology to enjoy life more. There was an essay I was reading recently by John Maynard Keynes from 1930, where he talked about how in the future the amount that we would all need to spend to take care of our necessities was going to become a smaller and smaller part of our budget, freeing people from the workaday world where they could simply work a little bit and take care of their necessities if they wanted to. Well, what happened? Here we are 70 years later, and we have had a great increase in technology, but we have not seen that case where necessities become cheaper and cheaper. And they haven't because we've gone on policies which have made food and housing expensive, and people have had to still have to work very hard to earn enough to pay off their mortgage and to pay rent on an apartment. Whereas these new technologies have become cheaper and cheaper, and people can afford, once they have a job, they can afford a higher standard of living. But people aren't still in that same vulnerable position they were many years ago, where they're afraid if they lose their job, they're going to lose their apartment, they're going to They're going to lose a lot of security. And if we have something like basic income, it can allow people a greater flexibility in order to enjoy some of the other benefits that come with our new technology, which is less pressure to work, 40 hours a day, 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year for our entire lives.
Now, I know there's no consensus in economics, just as there's even less in sociology about about these matters. But one popular radical political view is that during the Fordist era, during the previous to the 70s in the 20th century, there was a Western industrial model that if we paid workers a lot and if we acceded to labor demands, even though often it was begrudging concessions to labor, that we would bolster and build a capitalist economy through building the welfare state, through having more educated workforce and better healthy workforce and so forth. And that in the 70s, something happened, and some people think it was globalization or some increased amount of international competition, which began to put pressure on the welfare state model. And it seems like for many people to talk about a basic income in this current era after 30 years of increasing pressure, increasing forces that are pushing welfare states down, it seems somewhat utopian. I mean, how do you confront that? Do you, in the first place, do you agree that there is this historical shift away from the welfare state in the Western industrialized world? And secondly, do you think that it is a utopian demand, or is it an actual practical political demand?
Well, there certainly was a breakdown in the 1970s of an equilibrium or a consensus or some sort of agreement that was reached in Western societies between how the welfare state would be run, the role of labor unions, and the distribution of income. And there was certainly a breakdown in the early 70s. The causes of that breakdown are extremely complex. And after that, you also get a slower rate of growth on average. And you had some very frightening recessions at the time. And since then, we've recovered from the really deep recessions of the 70s. Even the current recessions have not been nearly as deep, although you never know, they could get deeper. But we have recovered that. We have not recovered our growth rate. But the thing to remember that a growth rate is an improvement. Whatever growth rate you have, it means you're doing better this year than next year. Our economy, with all the disruptions, is still quite a bit richer than it was in 1970. The people that aren't richer are the lowest 20% to 40% of the income bracket. What we've really had is a crisis of distribution, is that less and less of our growth is being distributed to the people who are most needy. And so you have a case where we're still growing, but yet that one segment of our society, the ones with the jobs that are the least attractive in many other ways, is not benefiting from the growth at all, where you have wages in the lowest sector have simply stagnated. It's not that they're simply growing slower than the other jobs, but the wages are stagnant or declining. And that happens over a period of decades, that means an entire class of people, millions of people, are seeing no progress for decades at a time, which is really unthinkable. It would have been unthinkable in America up to that point, after all the progress that we've had from the beginning of our country until then. Was there another part to your question?
The second part was, given the general perception that any kind of expansion of the welfare state or any kind of additional entitlements, at least this is clearly a perception since the Reagan era in the United States, but Margaret Thatcher kind of established and then Tony Blair continued the idea that the left had to take a new tack, that there had to be a new different way for the left that did not expand the welfare state. Doesn't it seem utopian in this context, or are there parties, right, left, center, who are taking up this idea of a basic income as an economic idea?
Well, it may seem utopian, but it is not utopian. It's actually a very simple, bare bones idea that has a good appeal across the political spectrum. When the welfare state was on the rise, conservatives were attracted to this idea as a conservative alternative to this big, powerful, clunky, hard-to-manage welfare state. Now, in the 30 years that the welfare state has been under attack, no conservatives have been appealed, no conservatives have found it appealing to have an idea to make the welfare state work better, because they've had so much success at simply dismantling the welfare state and replacing it with nothing, rather than replacing it with something cheaper and more effective. But this is not going to last forever. This attack on the welfare state is not going to last forever. People don't like walking by homeless people every day on their way to work and seeing more and more of them. People don't like knowing that the working class is not making it. Now, as much as groups that are opposed to the redistribution of income have been successful at keeping these things out of the public consciousness, they never go away permanently. They were around 1900. They disappeared during the 20s. They came back. They came back in the Depression era. Suddenly everyone was concerned. We got so many things in the Depression era, so many reforms, and also much of the welfare state was built during World War II, doing things that in the 20s would have seemed just politically inconceivable. And if you look at many of the major political changes in the U.S. throughout history, such as the abolition of slavery and the introduction of the New Deal, the Great Society, all of them were things that seemed impossible not that much earlier. Something sooner or later will happen to raise people's thoughts about the poor and make us realize that that our society produces a lot of goods and some people are missing out and they don't have to. And once that happens, we're not going to want to go and retrace all the mistakes of the Johnson and Nixon administrations. We're going to look for a new model. And then this sort of a model will become appealing to both sides across the political spectrum, because the left will be looking for something to expand and the right will be looking for something that's not going to have a bunch of overhead costs. And basic income can provide that bridge. So it needs to be there and a thought out and well-discussed idea when people are ready to listen to it.
I'm speaking with Dr. Carl Weiderquist. He's the American coordinator of the Basic Income organization, part of an international network of organizations working for a basic income, which is called the Basic Income Guarantee Network. And what's the website for that again, Carl?
It's usbig.net.
usbig.net.
Yeah.
Okay. One of the complaints that I foresee about this might come from the left, which is that if you look at our current entitlements, and actually the evidence is much more mixed, but one could say that if you look at something like Medicaid, or if you look at our current welfare benefits, that there is such we're such a stingy society that you probably, if we created this basic income, this citizen's income, it would be at such a low level that no one could really live off of it if they really needed to, and it would just continue our stinginess as a society.
Well, That's a difficult question. If there is a very low basic income, then it can't replace the welfare state. Now, there is a very low basic income in Alaska. I don't know if you know, but Alaska has the only existing basic income in the world, where a very foresighted Republican governor named Jay Hammond thought of the idea of using the state's new oil revenues after the Alaska pipeline was built to create a permanent basic income. So the oil revenues were taxed and then put into a fund, and every Alaskan gets the returns from gets their percentage of the return from this fund. Last year that gave every Alaskan, every man, woman, and child $1,500, $1,500, so that would be $6,000 for a family of four. Now, you can't live off $6,000 a year, especially in Alaska, which is a very expensive state, but it's not seen there as a welfare program. It is seen as everyone's right as the part owner of Alaska's resources. Now, that people will say that that's special to Alaska because they have all this oil. Well, it's not special to Alaska. We have lots of national resources in the United States. It's just that our government already gave them away for free.
The airwaves, for one.
That's right, airwaves. They're doing new things. They're always finding something new to give away all the time, such as the broadcast network. But if we taxed our natural resources, not even at a terribly high rate, but if we taxed land, mineral rights, things like the broadcast spectrum, pollution rights, which are just given to companies at no charge, if we taxed all of these things and created an Alaska-style fund, it could give us a small basic income that was a decent supplement. If you have a basic income that's not large enough as a supplement, it's just the key thing is to make sure that you don't think of it as a replacement for unemployment insurance and for everything else.
Carl, I understand that you're over there in England right now working on a second PhD.
Yes, I am. I studied economics because I was interested in policy issues, but I've realized that economics is good for understanding policy issues, but I'm also very interested in the ethical issues behind them. And a lot of economists work on the ethical issues, but are sort of amateur philosophers, and so I thought I'd get into it full-time and really study the ethics. And I managed to get a scholarship, so I'm like, well, I might as well, so here I am.
Now, have you plugged into the European network of this basic income organization? Seems pretty vibrant. Have you plugged into what they're doing over there?
Yeah, I've been in contact with them for some time. The European network is the Basic Income European Network, or BN, which, of course, means good in both French and Spanish with a little different pronunciation. So it's a very, very recognizable word across Europe. And it has people from, I think, every country in Europe are involved with BN, and it has affiliates in several European countries. And they've been around since the mid-1980s, and they hold the conferences every 2 years, and I've been going since 1996. Now, I became one of the people who founded the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network in the year 2000, something similar to BN, but not exactly the same. Theirs is more academics. Ours is made up of both academics and lay people and activists. And it was begun in the year 2000 when myself and an economist, Charles Clark from St. John's University, and two sociologists, Michael Lewis and Fred Block from out at UC Davis, we all got together to talk about basic income and decided to build a network for it. And since then we've put together a newsletter, a website. We just had our second conference in New York in February.
Are there parties in Europe who have adopted these ideas or promoting these ideas, other than the Greens? I presume the Greens are all over this.
Well, most Green parties have endorsed this idea, but not all of them. The American Green Party has endorsed it. It was in their platform in the last two presidential elections, but they didn't make an issue of it. Stanley Aronowitz did talk about it when he ran for New York governor under the Green Party last year.
Former guest on this show, actually.
Oh, yeah, good guy. He's actually been a speaker at our conferences. And also, most of the Green parties in Europe do, but not all of them do. The German Green Party had endorsed it and then dropped the idea shortly before they joined the ruling coalition at one point. Now, there in Belgium, there's an interesting history that although the Green Party endorsed basic income, a wealthy political entrepreneur actually started a party that was the Basic Income Party, and it was dedicated a one-issue party dedicated to basic income. And they actually managed in like 6 months of existence to get something like 2% of the vote in the Belgian election.
Would this idea be revenue neutral? I mean, you said that if we were to enter a deeper economic crisis, that conservatives might turn again to this idea as a way of simplifying the welfare state. And then we talked about the various levels that it might be funded at, and which could go from very minimal to generous. But in your basic proposal, what you talk to people about, would it be a revenue neutral stream? Would it be putting together all the current redistributive benefits and programs and just giving it to people's cash?
Well, that is one policy. I think that is like the Big Bang policy, is you cancel all these programs and you take all that money and you replace it with this one simplified, streamlined, brand new idea, and you got a much simpler government that merged much better. That's very appealing to to people like me who support basic income and to see it as a positive alternative.
Wouldn't be very popular with AFSCME or the SEIU or other public sector unions.
Right. But it is, it would also possibly be very appealing to some outsiders who've just been elected to high positions in government and really want to reform things. But if you talk to people that are involved in government all the time, they look at all these policies and that they're so entrenched and they don't want to... I can't say that I would cancel this policy because that's such a popular policy. And I say, yeah, but what if you were replacing it something with the supporters of that policy would like much better? And they would say, well, somebody could take that quote out of context. I just can't even say that. And so it's that sort of a big bang switch to basic income, as sensible as it is, is politically very difficult. And I think the Alaska model is more likely the way it's going to start, is if you start it as a new side program that doesn't really have anything to do with welfare, but if it grows large enough, then the welfare system becomes less and less necessary. The other thing is a possibility, but I really think that this is more the realistic way to go.
This is the end of the interview, but I want you to have an opportunity to tell people what to read next. I Googled the term basic income and came up with several thousand links, including about a dozen facts all over the place. And so, but is there a book that you think that your basic person interested in basic income should go to?
Well, there are so many books on it now that there's a wide range to choose from. If you're interested in philosophy, there's been a very influential philosophy book that came out in 1995 by Philippe von Peresch, who is a very well-respected philosopher who actually built up a philosophical case that led to the idea that basic income is the most desirable policy. And it's called Real Freedom for All: What, If Anything, Can Justify Capitalism. Now, if you don't want something like that, if you don't want something that's heavy-duty philosophy, you can. There's also books like The Basic Income Flat Tax Debate, which is heavy-duty economics. So if you don't want something as heavy-duty philosophy or heavy-duty economics, but more of an introduction for the layperson, there are also a variety to choose from. Al Sheehan has a very good introduction called The Guaranteed Income, which is unfortunately out of print. There are a list of several of them on the U.S. Big website at usbig.net. There's also on the website, there are a few papers that go into detail about what the policy is and how it works and how much it would cost to finance a certain level.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.